stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays, 1 to 2 p.m. on CliffCentral.com.
Good afternoon. It's just gone 1 o'clock on a Tuesday. That means it's time for the Daily Maverick audio show on CliffCentral.com. I'm joined in studio by the Brains Trust of the First Thing newsletter, the Beauty and the Beast. I'll leave it up to you to decide who is who, John Stupart and Andrea Teagle. Welcome, guys.
Thank you.
Cool. John, as editor of FT, you get kept up late at night and early in the morning by things happening around the world. What were the things that caught your eye that we published today in First Thing?
Yeah, there was a couple of things. There's always the Ebola thing, but I'm not going to go into too much detail about that since it was simply just the CDC changing its rules on how it treats Americans with Ebola, which frankly I think is a little less important to how West Africans treat each other with Ebola. But I think probably the biggest thing which I led with this morning was Rob Ford's mayorship has now ended.
Everyone's favorite mayor.
Yeah, I mean, he cracks me up. He's a fantastic guy, you know.
No pun intended.
No, never. Perish the thought.
You up, right.
you could say I'm quite addicted to the Canadian political landscape there. So anyway, he's no longer the mayor. He didn't run for election. I think that might be quite
important.
Can
you run from rehab? is there a stipulation in the legislation says you can't run from rehab?
I think looking at Rob Ford, you can run, just not very far or fast. For that matter, he had contracted rare cancer, which I suspect is it is the official reason for him not running again for mayorship this year. I think if he had run, he would have been utterly decimated in the elections anyway, which obviously is I think the real reason why he didn't actually run. He has made noises apparently in 4 years' time. I think that he wants to rerun. I suppose giving him a new maybe squeaky clean redemption image, you know, because North America I guess in general loves that, you know, I don't want to say dark horse image of a guy returning from being down in the dumps and coming back to ruling Canadian politics in all its glory.
But for all his faults, you got to give the man points for tenacity and, just wouldn't lie down throughout this whole thing, just kept coming back and kept holding his own.
Just defiant to the end like a South African politician. Yeah. He just absolutely refused. Eventually, the Toronto equivalent of municipality, limited his power. So he couldn't actually inflict too much damage on Toronto's political scene during his reign as mayor in chief.
But you are right. The Americans in particular, and I guess we lump the North Americans in like they do.
They're practically
Africans,
the same
right?
things.
You know,
yeah.
Same thing. Right. love that phoenix rising from the ashes story. You can only, you know, imagine him coming back in a couple of years' time, you know, having gone on a banting diet, maybe had some hair implants, found Jesus, and, you know, is, you know, squeaky clean, being clean, you know, clean for, a couple of months or years by then.
Although maybe his campaign in 4 years' time will be, it's okay, I'm not on crack. I'm on straight coke now. It's fine.
Yeah, you know, weed's legal in Colorado. You know, it's not a problem. Let's move. What else was news in First Thing today?
Well, I think aside from that, there was an interesting development where CJ Shivers, the author of a New York Times article, a recent New York Times article that pretty much blew the lid off chemical weapons being found in Iraq. He did a follow-up Q&A last night as part of the New York Times, and he was just talking about why the American government didn't actually discuss this or talk about it at the time, because it's a big thing. Even post fact, post Iraq war now, the discovery and destruction of chemical weapons, and I believe they were mustard gas shells in a significant quantity, is quite a big deal. And a lot of questions were just asking about why the U.S. government didn't actually disclose this, didn't publicize it at all. And his answer was pretty much to the effect of, I'm not entirely sure. He was just as baffled as the rest of us. Now, bear in mind, C.J. Shivers is also author, if I believe the correct book was called The Gun, which was also a fantastic novel about sort of arms and the world arms trade, I guess, and things like that.
So this would have supported America's or and the UK's arguments for going into the war, which was that Saddam had these weapons of mass destruction. So it does seem quite strange that, you know, having found some chemical weapons and of this magnitude, that they wouldn't have publicized it and used that in their sort of PR PR war against the war on terror.
Exactly. I think that's it's certainly a big deal for that specific reason, Silly. I think it's it would have been in my mind have been a partial justification. I did some reading on it when Shivers' article originally came out, and it turned out that a lot of these chemical weapons were simply so unstable that they couldn't take enough time to document them, bring in the chemical and biological teams to actually destroy the things safely, which would have taken days, if not weeks, to actually get the right teams to the right parts of Iraq to do this, and simply destroyed them as and where they lay then and there, which meant it was very, very difficult to get, I think, to document and to account for it. Whether that's the whole story, I doubt it, quite frankly. I think there's a lot more to this, and I think Shivers is onto something quite substantial here, and I think we'll certainly be hearing more about this in the coming weeks. Mm-hmm. And if it happens over, while everyone's sleeping, I'll be sure to write about it.
Andreas, one of your roles as a factistician on First Thing is to come up with some weird and wonderful facts to keep it bright and breezy amongst all the death and destruction that usually happens overnight. You've got a fun fact for us that I think in this day and age, had it happened in this day and age, would have trended with a hashtag epic fail.
Yeah, definitely. This is actually a special fact just for the radio show, so there you go, extra effort. So in 1964, a graduate student by the name of Donald Curry accidentally killed the oldest tree ever known to man.
As you do.
Yeah. As you do. So, yeah, to this day, there's never been an older tree discovered, and the tree was nicknamed Prometheus and was believed to be almost 5,000 years old.
I'm guessing got the nickname after they discovered it was the oldest one around.
Right. It has the nickname from the myth. It's supposed to warn against mankind's endless hunger for knowledge, which can basically lead to all kinds of terrible, detrimental, unforeseen effects. So anyway, the student was wandering around what is now the Great Basin National Park, and he was trying to get an idea of how old this group of great bristle cone pine trees are.
Oh, so not the redwoods. The redwoods are usually the ones people think of as big old ones.
Well, actually, these trees aren't even particularly big. They only grow to about 6 meters. So, I mean, he could really be forgiven for thinking that he's not going to be inadvertently stumbling across the oldest tree ever known to man.
Oh, wow.
And anyway, he got his increment borer stuck in the tree. So this is the instrument that you insert into the wood and take out a sample so that you can just count the rings on that piece of wood, so as not to destroy the tree.
Almost sounds like something you could buy in an Amsterdam sex shop, but increment borer.
Well, apparently it was stuck in the tree and he was trying to get it out for quite some time when a forest ranger came across him and took pity on him and said, "You know what, son? That's never going to come out. Let's just chop the tree down." And they proceeded to do that.
This is not really his fault either.
Afterwards, counting the rings, you get to around 4,900 and you start thinking, shoot, we may have messed this up. But I mean, on the upside, I guess we never would have known that was the oldest tree unless they chopped, if this hadn't happened.
Yeah, I do believe after that he kind of gave up on the study of trees and whatever that field of study is called.
I don't think he's famous for anything else. So I suppose at least he has that.
Goodness. Yeah, I believe he went and studied lakes or something after that. He moved into something that you can't destroy. Oh, yeah.
He should have just gone into timber felling.
Well, also, I mean, because of him, now the Great Basin National Park became the Great Basin National Park, and all those trees are protected. So, at least something positive came of it.
Well, some good did come of it, yeah.
You have to kill the oldest one to make an example for the others.
Exactly.
I did also did a little bit of reading about this as well, and I think the oldest one now that's still alive, it now belongs in a different state, and they're quite happy they can lay claim to that. But, very unfortunate for the poor guy. Andrew, you've done some traveling in the last week or so. You were off to Botswana to go and monitor and cover the elections that happened over there. Tell us about that.
I was lucky enough to go with Simon Allison, who does all the regional coverage for Daily Maverick. It was very, very interesting, actually. We met up with a journalist who'd done a preview of the elections. This was on Thursday. And what was interesting was the people who we spoke to really weren't keen, in fact, to talk about politics at all. They were very jittery, didn't want to be quoted, didn't want their names out there. And as it happened, we managed to get hold of an opposition member for one of the wards of one of the rival parties. So he wasn't the main leader, his name was Warabile Motaleng, of the Botswana Congress Party, who were the official opposition, although in this current election now, an umbrella group, the Umbrella for Democratic Change, has actually overtaken them. Anyhow, he had this crazy story to tell us about how he'd been abducted in the middle of the night, stripped down and tortured, basically, and asked about basically the names of all the members of the party and where they were concentrated, you know, in the different districts. And it was crazy. He was talking with his neck brace on and had crutches, visible scars on his skin, and sounded really, really quite afraid, in fact.
This is quite in contrast to the sort of international image that Botswana has as almost a poster boy for democracy in the region, or even, in fact, on the continent.
Yeah, and I think it really has been, you know, up until now. This is very, very recent, this turn of events, seeing, you know, these tactics of intimidation under Ian Khama's rule. So he's been president now for 6 years, and, as we know, is recently re-elected, which was expected, but these were the first elections where there was really any chance of the opposition taking over the ruling party. And I guess that's a scary time, you know, for a new democracy. That's when you really see whether, you know, what path they're going to take. And I think a lot of people in Botswana actually, you know, weren't aware that there were anything like this going on. And many think that, you know, the party is shoot-straighting and the elections were, you know, perfectly... Mm.
Isn't that the scariest time when the incumbent does sense a potential loss of power?
Exactly. We're not there yet, so.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the closer we do get to that, becomes scarier and scarier, because the ruling party then is faced with a fork in the road. Which way do you go? Do you go the way of an oppressive tyrant, intimidating government, or do you just, you know, let your reins go peacefully? And it's very few, it's not very often that it happens that the peaceful option is the one that gets taken.
Mm. Well, I mean, in Khama's case, I think being a former military senior officer, now being involved in politics, you kind of do a little bit of both. You know, it's not necessarily, you know, being a
Bob Mugabe style.
Yeah,
right.
Neither a Mugabe nor a Mandela, but something, somewhere in between, where you're looking at very, very, I don't want to say surreptitious and covert intimidation, as you're explaining there. Mm. But at the same time, the elections themselves, at least from what I've read and what I've seen, appear to have been held quite freely, quite fairly, and quite transparently, which I think Botswana cannot get away from anymore. That said, I don't think military intimidation, or not necessarily military intimidation, I don't think electoral intimidation is enough to save Khama at this point, especially now that I suspect opposition parties smell blood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that's nothing quite like feeling like you have a chance, I think, to carry on the opposition.
I think the BDP was also carried through by the fact that the public media space is really dominated by the state. So people in the rural areas, you know, we were in Gaborone, you know, don't really hear about these things. So I don't know. I guess as that starts to change, people
that's a problem that we face in South Africa as well. Is the only media that gets out to the rural population is generally SABC created content. You know, the SABC radio reaches 22 million people in this country, which is a major part of the population. And something that we saw in the last elections was the split between the rural and the urban vote, where the decline in the ANC's popularity in urban areas was more marked than the rural areas. And we're seeing this play out over and over again. And why media will always remain such a big target and such a big space for any government in terms of getting the necessary vote and backing of those people, or keeping scandals out of the limelight so that they don't lose their position of power. And moving on to another story that you worked on this week, was the story of sort of in some ways touching, in some ways sad, I guess, the story of Jenna Lowe and what she's done as a to sort of take the organ donor movement to social media. It's quite an inspiring story. You got to chat to her over last week, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. It really is an amazing story. I think a lot of people have heard of it now, particularly probably in the younger generations. Jenna's Get Me to 21 campaign, which was launched on Facebook and YouTube and Twitter. Basically, the idea behind it is she personally invites people to join her at her 21st birthday by becoming an organ donor.
How old is she now?
So she's 19.
19. And she needs
a lung transplant if she's going to make it to her 21st birthday. She was diagnosed with pulmonary arterial hypertension, which is quite a rare disease, a couple of years ago. And since then, actually advocated for, you know, awareness for PH prior to moving on to the organ donor cause. Mm-hmm. She really is just a really, really great person. And it's actually difficult because, you know, I, like, speaking to her, I was really, really moved by her story and just her the absence of anger, you know, in that situation in which she's found herself and her determination to bring something good out of it rather than, you know, just questioning the unfairness that she's in this position. But also how she's really determined not to be thought of as this, she doesn't think of herself as an inspirational person. So it's difficult because on the one hand, you know, I want to call her extraordinary. On the other hand, I know that that's not actually how she wants to come across. And she very much sees herself as an ordinary person who's, you know, just trying to do the best she can for other people who find themselves in a similar situation to her.
But it has been incredible to see the effect that this campaign has had. For her personally. I mean,
so
she's
amazing.
Had.
So the campaign is run purely by her and her family, primarily her mom. Her sisters also help out quite a bit, I think, with getting it out there. But just through the campaign alone, there are about, I think it must be nearing about 5,000 new donors just through Get Me to 21. And that is an incredible number considering that in South Africa, they're only 0.2% of the population is even registered as an organ donor. I mean, she's had a tremendous impact on getting young people, especially, I think, you know, just to say, well, actually, yeah, sure, I want to be an organ donor, you know, let me sign up. I hadn't signed up before hearing about the campaign, you know, not because I'm against it in any way. I really just hadn't thought of it. And the studies which have looked at attitudes among South Africans, which I researched for the story, reflected a similar sort of finding, you know, that it's more about a lack of awareness than it is about, you know, unwillingness to donate in a lot of cases. Obviously, there are cultural barriers, but not as prominent as you might.
Some interesting facts that came out of that was that for every person who signs up as an organ donor, there's a potential that, you know, that the organs could go to 7 different people as a maximum, which is incredible to think
it
that you could save 7 people's lives. And
that's not necessarily one organ, one donor to one recipient. It's
exactly.
Exponential.
And the other one, which was quite strange and not really something that, probably requires more research, is that women are more likely to sign up as organ donors than men, which is quite strange.
Yeah, I found that interesting, and I actually wanted to, you know, hypothesize on why this could be, but really couldn't, pinpoint a good reason for it. But, yeah, apparently it's about 2/3 women who are organ donors. And even in Jenna's campaign, it's been primarily women who are, more than 50% women who've responded.
To put on the broad brush, I would almost say it's an empathy thing. It sounds awful to say, but I suspect maybe South African men are just not as, caring, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean,
just a thought. Yeah. I mean, I don't know.
I would like to believe that's not the case. You
hopefully
know, that there isn't a gender divide in that way. But
it would be interesting to match it up against blood donation statistics.
Yeah, it would be.
And see if it is there.
It might also be the way that the campaigns are structured. Mm. You know, who they're targeting and who responds. But I don't really know about that. But also, I think it's important to mention that in South Africa there are a lot of structural issues as well. We really need more transplant coordinators who are trained emergency care nurses. Mm-hmm. We only have about 20 of them across the whole country. And without these people, you know, the families can't be approached to be asked whether they'd be prepared to, you know, donate the organs of their recently deceased loved ones. So yeah, they play an incredibly important role, and we really just don't have enough of them. So a lot of the transplant opportunities that we do have, I think don't actually translate into donations.
So if you're listening to the podcast, I seriously urge you to go check out Get Me to 21. It's a fantastic initiative, and yeah, I mean, hopefully Jenna gets her new set of lungs and gets to 21. We'll certainly be rooting for her. On the line today, we've got Brooke Spector, associate editor at the Daily Maverick. Brooks, how are you, and how is your gin and tonic today?
Good afternoon. It wasn't a gin and tonic, but it was a roast beef sandwich on rye bread and a hot chili pepper. But nevertheless, but we're sitting by the pool.
Okay, good. Working on your tan. That's an image I really didn't need to get out of my head.
Thinking about the next story, I'm chained to the computer for.
Brooks, you wrote a piece on civil disobedience yesterday that I quite enjoyed, and you tried to sort of relay it into the South African context. Tell us a little bit more about your thoughts on that.
You there?
Yep, Brooks.
Hello? Yeah, still, I'm here. Sorry, I heard a click and a whir, and telecommunications technology sent us apart. What I did was... It's really easy to get annoyed and frustrated and sort of quivering with rage about all the waste, fraud, mismanagement, theft, and general thuggery about with government accounts. And it's very easy to be sort of reduced to an impotent kind of fury, you know, dashing off letters, angry letters to the newspapers, or, you know, increasingly intemperate posts on Facebook or Twitter, or calling up a radio station and just saying, I am aghast, this kind of thing. But I said, you know, let's look at this historically, and let's look at this in a bigger context. What is civil disobedience, and where does it take a society? That was the pitch. And I reached back to a man by the name of Henry David Thoreau, an American philosopher in the 1840s and 50s, He wrote Walden, which most people have heard of, about the man who goes off to the woods to live by a pond so that he can live his life deliberately rather than at the depredations of everyday life. But he also wrote this extraordinarily important and influential essay on civil disobedience, and he effectively defined it for the first time. He defined it so well that people as Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi picked up on his idea and worked it into their political social philosophies, philosophies of action for social change. And in Thoreau's case, it started out with, the U.S. had declared war on Mexico in 1845, in part to officially conquer Texas and then to gain control of California. But at least in a sub rosa kind of way, to expand slavery into other territories. And Thoreau was sufficiently incensed by it that he refused to pay a necessary poll tax, and the authorities dutifully arrested him. And although his friends eventually bailed him out, they were embarrassed that one of their set would spend nights in jail. It propelled him into writing about civil disobedience. How does one formulate a way to register with the government other than simply at the election, that you disagree fundamentally with the government policy and you're prepared, as Thoreau explained it, you were prepared to go to jail if necessary so as not to be part of this implacable machinery? And how do you then bring together enough people so that the government is stopped in its tracks from doing a particular policy? He wasn't advocating revolution. He wasn't, you know, he wasn't saying that you have to go storm the Winter Palace or anything like that. But he was saying you have to focus on actual policies and figure out ways to get them to change. And the way he best conceived of it was to withhold the legitimacy of taxes or other revenues until effectively you convince the government to change its policy. And, of course, there is a South African context to this as well. In the 1980s, there was a significant effort at the withholding of rents and electricity payments in many townships across the country as a strike against government in response to the increasing occupation of the townships by police and even the military. And there was one year, and I'm trying to remember whether it was 1986 or 87, the year of the Black Christmas, in which there was effectively a purchasing strike against merchants and businesses for the traditional buying of gifts and foodstuffs for the Christmas holiday period. And so what I was doing was drawing together these various strains and saying, is there a mechanism in all of this to register not just an annoyance with, but a way out for people who are entirely tired of the headlines that they see? But, and here was the real challenge, is the middle class, the people who pay a good chunk of the taxes and who make these annoyances, are they prepared to be arrested for the purpose of registering their discontent with the way the government proceeds?
Mm.
And that's a question, and I don't have an answer for it, and I'm not sure anybody does yet.
Does the Opposition Against Urban Tolling Alliance ring a lot of, or draw a lot of parallels from Thoreau's philosophies?
Well, it does. And I made reference to it in the article, that in many ways I think this was the first moment in the new dispensation where this had happened. Now, all right, there's a residual effect here still of people who refused to pay rent or electricity bills in townships in the 1980s and 1990s, and some people still do. But the urban toll, the alliance against the urban, the e-tolling process was a new way of recognizing this. I mean, I personally know very few people who have an e-tag, and I don't know all that many people who are prepared to pay the bills when they show up. But the problem or the challenge is going to come if someone is dragged to court or even issued a summons or even arrested for non-payment. What's the response of everybody else at that point? And that's where we have to look back at Thoreau's essay on civil disobedience again.
Well, sorry, I would just to jump in there. I'd say the reason e-tolls, at least in South Africa, encourage that mass civil disobedience, and the reason why you could make a case to argue that it's working, is because the costs of disobedience is so low. You know, there isn't even a Thoreau kind of case where you get arrested and even spend one night in jail. And I think even that would, if there was a threat and a reliable threat that there's even one night you will spend in jail, I think you would find tag registration in this country quite, you know, it would increase quite considerably straight after that. That's my thought anyway.
Well, that's quite the point. That the middle class, which is primarily middle class broadly speaking, we're not talking about upper middle here. We're talking about the average Joe who has a car and who has to use the highways. Almost called them freeways, but of course they're not free anymore. Anyway, I mean, when you reach the point where there's a real personal cost, the middle class traditionally in history in South Africa, no differently than almost any other place, is effectively designed to be law-abiding, because that's how they move forward. They get up in the morning, they go to work, they pay their bills, and they rise gradually through the system and profit thereby. When it comes to that moment where somebody is being dragged off to the pokey, then you know whether or not the cost was too high to bear, or whether or not you find vast numbers of people rallying to that person's defense. In Thoreau's case, of course, his transcendentalist friends in the Boston Academy quietly got together and paid his poll tax for him so he could go back and write his essays, even if it was just for that bit. But the question that I guess everybody has to ask is, have we reached that moment where somebody will engage in a defining act of civil disobedience against the shenanigans at the SABC or the fact that ESCOM wants to spend 40-some million rand to buy breakfast with officials in a some sort of spurious public relations gesture. Will people then make that choice? And if so, how are they going to do it, quote-unquote, spontaneously? And how are they going to respond if the authorities decide that there's a test case to be made here?
Well, I mean, I would say it's certainly in a, just like any good insurgency or proto-revolution, there's a third option where you could try, as you finished off there, you could try and incite a reaction from the government and create that violent reaction that seems so disproportionate on the global stage, and particularly with, you know, the way media and communications is structured these days, that's certainly a very easy mistake to make by the government, by wielding, as you said in your article, the complete monopoly of force that they own. And I think if that happens, you could very quickly, rapidly encourage mass disobedience, and I dare say mass resistance against the government. I mean, not to say that's – I don't think ETOLS is particularly going to create a battle of Algiers in South Africa, but I think – the middle class, as you say, we like our stuff too much to want to risk our own asses.
Exactly.
What we need is basically the blue collar, the working class. It sounds horrible, but it's the historical reality I find as well for most insurgencies is if you are able to get the masses involved, even in any sort of way, so that at least you are not directly threatened initially, I think that's a pretty good catalyst for resistance. The case in point being during Mandela's funeral, the booing of President Zuma at the stadium, the middle class, I talk here broadly, as well as most media sort of outlets were saying, is this the tipping point? Is this the cusp of, you know, the you know, is this going to be the end of the government as we know it? And sort of all sorts of noises about that. But it petered away because there wasn't that mass mobilization that the middle class can then harness, almost as its sort of revolutionary stallion, as you know, as happened in the Arab Spring and has happened many, many times before. And I think we just don't have that critical mass yet. And I don't know if it'll be one specific instant, or if it's a violent reaction from the government, or if it's a collection of ETOLs and service delivery and. I mean, I'm not sure.
I think you need to tell listeners you're listening to International Political Theory 101. the reading assignments will be handed out tomorrow. It will be an essay due on Friday.
Correctly.
What this does do is it, if all those things are true, it pushes a government into either being resistant and obdurate, or supple and resilient. At some point, a government says, you know, cost for doing X is just too high. We have to get rid of it or fix it or do it differently. And ETOLS is a pretty good example of that. But how does a government do that with power outages or wasteful spending at the national broadcaster, or the website for the Free State government that costs more than the national budget of a small country? I mean, you know, those are the problems. Those are things that make you really upset if you pay your taxes and behave like a good boy. They may not be quite so annoying to people who have even more immediate concerns in their life. But another political philosopher that I like to look back on is Alexis de Tocqueville, a Frenchman who visited the U.S. in the 1830s to try to figure out how American democracy made any sense. But he wrote another later story about Tsarist Russia, and he defined political problems for Tsarist Russia. He said, the most dangerous time for a regime is when a bad regime attempts to reform. And when he said bad, he didn't necessarily mean evil. He meant bad in the sense of incoherent or inept or inefficient, as well as not good in a more normative sense. And the government here faces these challenges and doesn't always have an easy way to get them fixed. I mean, who's going to leap forward to to stop the bling excesses of government departments? Who's going to really rise up and say, we've got to fix the SABC or else? And who is going to move forward to say, ESCOM, you cannot spend enormous gouts of cash on a gymnasium for your top employees when you need to borrow extraordinary amounts of money from the government lest the lights go out? I don't know if you want to call them middle class concerns, but they're awfully abstruse and divorced from the immediate vicissitudes of everyday life, aren't they?
Mm. Absolutely. Brooks, we're almost out of time for you, because we've got Marianne in time. We're about to get the latest update on the Shrin Devani case from Cape Town. But before you go, and before we zap your eardrums to pieces, a crossing to Brooke Spector wouldn't be complete without a quick theatre comment. We usually ask you what's good on at the theatre that you can recommend, but I see you've been gushing about War Horse.
We saw it on Sunday, and I am amazed. The people who brought those horses on stage, they made them look like puppets, and they were so well-behaved. No, all kidding aside, it is an extraordinary piece of theater, and you will hate yourself if you don't go see it. It's too intense for little kids, even though it's a children's story, 8, 10 years old and above, maybe. But it is such a piece of beautiful, beautifully portrayed theater about loyalty and love and the nature of war, that you must go. And then that's over at the Monte Cassino Theater. And then at the Market Theater starting on Thursday is a work called The Last Anniversary, which is a play built around a theater company that is doing an opera, which was composed by Jan Meowitz and written to a libretto by the author Langston Hughes. So it's a joint South Africa, French, and a couple of other European countries production. It's touring very successfully in Europe, and now it's coming to Johannesburg on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, I believe. War Horse runs through the early part, late November, I believe, and then moves to Cape Town. So go see both, and consider your theater budget well spent for the month.
Good. Thanks, Brooke Spector, for joining us from Parkhurst. We'll chat to you soon. On the line from Cape Town, we've got Marianne Tam. Marianne, are you there?
I'm here. Here I am.
Hello. I believe you've been suffering through another day of trial at the Shrin Devani trial.
Yes, it's been an interesting morning because, of course, one of the issues from the start of the trial has been whether any evidence that would point to any relationship Shrin Devani had with people other than Annie were admissible, particularly his relationship with the German master, Leopold Leiser, whom he met online through Gaydar. And both teams have been trying to, defense, of course, is questioning the relevance of this information, while the state is trying to prove that it shows a context in which the infidelity, as they call it, happened. Judge Traversa ruled this morning that the evidence about the personal nature of the relationship, including the fact that Shrin had slept over at the German Meister's apartment on two occasions, was inadmissible. And the defense also posited it's been quite interesting in court this morning, saying that Annie Devani had broken off the engagement in May 2010, and so Shrin had ample time to actually extricate himself from the relationship then, yet he chose to continue to have the relationship and marry her. So that was this morning's proceedings. And just before lunch, we were listening to driver Zola Tongo, who is serving an 18-year sentence, and his version of the events. What's quite striking is how much of this crime was caught on CCTV. It's a crime committed in the 21st century. And obviously the most interesting part as well is that what happened in Google, the actual killing and hijacking itself, is not on camera, which indicates, I think, a meta-narrative of how townships are kind of left out of the bigger policing picture.
Marianne, have you noticed since the other trial has ended that international media interest has picked up again in this case?
Yes, some of the journalists have returned from Pretoria and are attending this particular case. It's a bit of a scrum every morning in terms of getting our ringside seats. But certainly there's much less international focus. I think particularly the British media is here and are interested, and the BBC is here, and most of the dailies and the weeklies. There's no American interest in it, and very little European interest. So it's mostly a South African and a UK case.
Given the amount of obviously local and international focus on the Oscar trial, have you noticed, and obviously having years of experience in court cases and covering court cases, have you noticed any significant changes in how this trial is being conducted?
I think what's interesting is to see how the international media responds to the rulings, or how the court views evidence procedures in court itself, what is admissible and what's not admissible. It's interesting to look that today the Daily Mirror in the UK have published Leopold Elias's entire statement, which was made available to us through various channels, but South African media have chosen not to exploit that particular statement. It is rather sensational because the court has ordered that it is not admissible. So there's an interesting a difference in approach to what the media in South Africa is willing to run. It was said this morning that we self-censor, and we were very quick to argue that it had nothing to do with self-censoring, but it has to do with obeying the law of South Africa, which is quite interesting. So I wrote a piece last week in the Daily Maverick for me personally about how transformed the courtroom is since the 30 years I was last here, the diversity of the media bench, the attitudes of the court orderlies and other people, and the respect for the rights of not only the accused but of witnesses, and that's very, very evident and obvious to me.
Marianne, which way do you think, you know, it's sort of a boxing match, you know, one round to the defense, one round to the prosecution. What would you put the score at as now?
I would say the defense 3, the state 0 at this point.
Wow. Okay. And how long is the trial expected to run
trial
for?
This is not.
It's expected to run through December, and sentencing is if he's found guilty, well, sentencing means either he gets off or he gets sent to jail, is expected to happen early next year. But I have a suspicion that it might end sooner. I'm not quite sure. I think after the various witnesses have been brought before court, that the defense might call for an acquittal.
Okay, and yesterday's indication by the NPA to appeal, or give the indication that they would go ahead with an appeal on the Oscar case, what's your take on that?
Well, I think if the NPA in this particular case feels that the judge did not take evidence into account that it presented, they obviously clearly feel that they have a winnable case. I'm not sure whether that is the case, but as you know, it's up to the state and up to the NPA to present a case that the judge then has to weigh up in terms of evidence. And in this particular case, the state so far has not presented any evidence which points to any motive whatsoever for this extremely bizarre and strange killing. So in the Oscar case, I think there are more legal issues that you could argue, and those who've been following the case know all about dolus eventuatis. That's not a legal issue in this particular case. So I think in that case, it probably would succeed. I'm not sure whether it would happen in this case.
All right. Marianne, I'm from Cape Town, following the Shireen Devani case. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Julie.
Cheers, Marianne. Okay, so we got a couple minutes before we round up. Guys, what's ahead for the week? What are you expecting to come up in first thing? You know, what are you keeping your eye on, John?
I've got my eye on wine is what I've got my eye on. definitely going to be hitting Winex this week. I believe it starts tomorrow, Craig. I think
Friday. Daily Maverick Media Partners of the Wine Expo, happening at the Sandton Convention Center, Wednesday, Thursday and Friday.
I should also clarify that long before I started working for Daily Maverick, I've been a fan of Winex, and I have many, many black holes in my memory from visiting the Sandton Expo Center there. From that aside, I think what I should be probably paying attention to, aside from the wine, will be obviously the battle for Kaban still goes on, despite it not being in the news. I do expect we'll hear something about that going through the week, either a definitive victory for the Kurds, Kurdish Shias coming in there, or a pushback by ISIS coming through there. I suppose we'll see either which way that goes. There'll always be Ebola, of course, sadly. Mm-hmm. Aside from that, all I can say is coming up in terms of dates and important things is just those of you old enough to remember, is Remembrance Day is coming up in a couple of weeks. So if you see some geriatrics at the mall selling poppies, it's not gay pride. It is actually something to do with veterans and just sort of remembering the soldiers who have fought and fallen for whatever cause. It's completely apolitical and an entirely honorable charity, I think. Fully supported.
You mentioned ISIS. Just reminded me of one or two sort of weird stories that came out over the last week. Is a Belgian chocolate company called ISIS that had to rebrand and change its name for obvious reasons. And I believe the dog in Downton Abbey is also called ISIS.
Oh, lovely.
Which is rather unfortunate for the poor fella.
There's an animated series called Archer as well, where their organization, which ironically is a counter-terrorist spy organization, is called ISIS. So they've apparently also renamed themselves as well. Very unfortunate if you happen to buy a T-shirt or something for the show.
One of the funniest reports I read last night as well was I think it was American Airlines flight from LAX to London was aborted when one of the passengers was busy on his phone, the minutes before the plane was due to take off, and was looking for a Wi-Fi hotspot and noticed the one right at the top was called the Al-Qaeda Free Terror Network as a Wi-Fi hotspot, and as a result,
was it stable?
Yeah, I love the word. You know, they just made sure to keep free in there, which was great. Right. And the Al-Qaeda network was obviously quite funny. But yeah, the flight was grounded. Everyone was forced to disembark. People were put over in hotels. People, obviously missed their business appointments. Because some smart ass thought it would be a fun idea to rename his Wi-Fi hotspot on an American Airlines plane from LAX.
That stuff's actually no joke. My brother and I had a conversation about various, like, if we were hypothetically going to hijack a plane, this is years ago, at Durban Airport, International Airport, and we were, just talking hypothetically because, that seemed like a good thing to do in the queue while waiting to fly. And apparently my brother got pulled over as he checked in by the police, and they said, "Where was that guy you were with?" He said, he's my brother. He's gone home now. He just dropped me off." And he got questioned for a while. Mm. So anyone who thinks our counter-terror police are not vigilant, wow, they're ugly somewhat vigilant.
That's actually quite surprising and quite impressive.
Yeah, I believe it's now actually a proper crime, so yeah. Just as well it happened.
So
before
next
it
time you're in the market for a body cavity search, feel free.
If you're feeling lonely.
Yeah. Andrea, anything on the radar for you? Are you looking at anything? You've done a couple of health pieces so far, done really well on DM.
I'm not sure.
Putting you on the spot. The FT, our resident FT factistician. All right, guys, I think that's it for the week. That's the Daily Maverick show on Cliff Central. You can catch the podcast. We're now on iTunes. You can subscribe to iTunes. It'll download automatically, or you can catch the podcast from the Daily Maverick website or the cliffcentral.com website. We look forward to having you with us next week.
The Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com.